Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Hi.
Hasn't been long, Pat. Has been only a couple days.
Only a few days. I just posted the last show on your way up while you were driving. Oh, so it's nice. Up. It's up.
So let me.
I had it edited a few days ago, and then, you know, because like that part's pretty much like click, 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 click. Then like, I got to tag it. Then I got to get the notes, put the notes in there, upload it all. So I just did that today.
Did you use the old filter?
I used the old filter, yes.
Cool. Yeah.
And the show title is 2 times 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 2.
It was 255, though.
Oh, shit. Minus one. Ah, I didn't even think of that whole starting at zero, but doing the multiplication is going to... Oh, damn.
Well.
Oh, well.
So for those of you who caught that error...
It took Greg 3 seconds. I'm sure others will, too.
Speaking of errors...
I was going to call it We're All Out of Bits, but... I should have called it that.
Yeah. You can change it, right? I mean...
Yeah, now that it's up, it'll be a pain.
All right. So we can call this one We Got More Bits. Or whatever. Speaking of corrections, I have a couple corrections to make of the stuff that I talked about in the post-show.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. I was talking about lambda the whole time. Lambda is the cosmological constant. Gamma is the Lorentz factor. I blame the beer.
I blame Lorentz for starting with L.
It's yeah, exactly. There's that too. And it's it smells good. This is the
Southern Tier IPA. They may have the 2X IPA, but I just have a special place in my heart for the old-fashioned, plain old IPA. I do like 2X IPA better than their unearthly Imperial IPA.
Anyway, the other correction I have is that I didn't talk about this. It's not so much of a correction, but an omission that I, when I was describing relativity, I didn't even think to include this, which is dumb of me, but I didn't even talk about length contraction, which is an important part of the whole deal. We were talking about how someone on a spaceship, your mm-hmm. person A is on a spaceship, person B is on a spaceship, person A rockets off in another direction, that acceleration affects their gamma, affects their time dilation. But then once they stop accelerating, then it's a symmetrical system, so both ways are the same. But the problem, mm-hmm. but person A, person B will see, well, let's say person A, the person who's rocketing forward, will see basically the universe in the direction that they're moving shrink.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that their time to get to a certain place is considerably smaller than it would be for person B, because they seem to take less time. In fact, person B sees person A shrink.
The front half of person A.
Well, the part that's moving in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
So that has a lot to it. And the way you can think about this, and I was just reading up on it just to make sure I was saying the right things, but the way you can think about this is that, okay, let's say person B is sending, every year they send a signal, an anniversary signal, you know, say, happy, mm-hmm. Happy New Year, Happy New Year, Happy New Year. As person A rockets away, those will get spread apart. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, first they're both from the perspective of each, and they're both going away from each other at a particular speed, and then they're going to be redshifted. And then when person A turns around, suddenly all those get bunched up and they get blue shifted.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see how time gets affected in that way.
A couple weeks ago, we were talking about the NSA stuff, and we lost the beginning of the post show. Remember that? We lost the beginning of the post show.
Yes,
thing
yeah.
Freaked out on us. And the part I was talking about was I did some back of the napkin calculations on how much space and power this 5 zettabyte number would take up. And I won't waste a lot of time on it, but just to recap, there's a huge lab that I used to work for, when I worked for NetApp down in RTP. It held 1,250 racks. And if you took the densest storage that is commercially available, filled every rack with this stuff and had no networking, no nothing, just hard drives, right? You would only get about, what was it, 2.5 petabytes. So an exabyte is 1,000 petabytes. And they're talking about five of these.
Mm-hmm.
And you're getting two out of this huge football field sized room. And then the power was more back of the napkin. I was trying to remember what the power was for that building, multiply it out, stuff like that. And I mean, you're talking like several power plants, just the power, the NSA data farm.
The NSA, so, you know, they could have their own nuclear reactor on.
Sure. But I was listening to Security Now on their Q&A thing, you know, a couple weeks after they had talked about the NSA mm-hmm. thing. And a guy from NetApp wrote in and had almost identical numbers to the ones I came up with. So I was pretty excited about that. I'm like, he's like, the densest storage I know has 60 drives and five. I'm like, he's talking about the same box. And it's not a NetApp product either, because NetApp doesn't have anything that crazy dense. But he was talking about the same product I had in mind. It's called the Backblaze box. And then he was basically building up their big lab at RTP, you know, did the same math I did. So I was glad to see it validated where the numbers, you know, Greg will argue that the NSA problem may have some other kind of storage that isn't traditional commercial storage. But I'm glad other people were like, you know, saying, hold on a second, this five zetabyte number just is impractical. You know, it's the number I came up with is 1.2 billion hard drives. You know,
that's a lot.
And like,
the failure rate on that would be really
right. That's hundreds of drives failing a day.
Yeah.
You know, it's insane. And then, you know, other people, like, I'm almost wondering if the author of the article, you know, thought a zettabyte was like a zillion and just a made up number.
your computer just went blank. I don't know if that's
a good thing. I haven't turned off the, I got to put on the.
It means you have to type in your password every time.
Yeah, I'll just hit the little caffeine thing here, and that'll screensaver will not kick on. Yeah, so I don't want to tie up a lot of time with it. It's old in the news, but when you hear numbers like 5 zettabytes, try to do them. If you know someone in storage, ask them how much material that is, and mm-hmm. it just boggles.
So what is the Security Now response to that?
It was kind of like, you know, they were proud of the listeners for being skeptical. You know, like, they hadn't thought of it. They had just taken it, like... So I'm like, come on. I mean, Leo Laporte is like your crazy old uncle anymore. He doesn't, I don't think he pays attention to what the people are saying on the show. He's kind of like just monitoring the chat room and trying to figure out, like, I swear he's like phoning it in anymore. Steve Gibson, I think, still puts on a good show. But I mean, for the past couple of years, Leo's like that crazy old uncle that doesn't, you know, can't understand what's
going on. He's a producer
now.
He's not, he's not a talent. He's mm-hmm. a producer. The scope of what is said about it vastly outweighs the logical possibilities of what really could be done.
Mm-hmm.
As long as we're dealing with things that aren't magic. Like I said, I mean, it is possible that the NSA could have some kind of brand new storage system that no one knows about, but the likelihood that they would be using that on such a large scale...
Right.
Starts to make you wonder.
I mean, this whole secret thing, it breeds grandeur and awe.
Yeah.
And like, they, you know, you hear that over and over in spy agencies. We actually have a guy at work who used to work for the NSA. And, you know, I didn't get any good juicy bits out of him. But the one thing he did say was, you know, when things are secret, things get blown out of proportion. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you know,
I think he was just trying to play it down. I think he was really
saying. Oh, yeah. I grew up in D.C. I know how... You know, I've known people who work for the government, and the government is made up of people, and people are fallible, and they have to try to impress their bosses so they will say things that are big and not being big. I mean, this mm-hmm. the presentation that was on the Washington Post was just, it was obvious that it was just somebody trying to brag about how awesome their thing was when really they could do one tenth of that if
mm-hmm.
so it's. Yeah, a lot of it is, and I think that I started to wonder whether the United States decided to use that to its advantage. This information got out, but why not make them think we can do this?
Right.
As opposed to telling them, no, we can't really do this, but right. make them think we can.
Well, speaking of what they can and breaking encryption and whatnot, in a different story... You know, the SSL encryption keys for websites and mm-hmm. stuff, traditionally they've been 1,024 bytes
right.
for the asymmetric encryption. And this time around, right now, all the 1024s are expiring and most of the renewals are 2048 bits, double the bit size, which is exponentially stronger key.
Right.
for $1 million, you can, with today's computing capacity, for $1 million, you can crack a 1024-bit key in a year. And it scales linearly. So for $100 million, you could do it in 3 days.
Huh.
So the 1024 key is not strong enough anymore. Right.
But a 2048 would be...
Right, right. But I mean, that just... I mean, $100 million is nothing for a state to put together a cracking farm. And, oh, and look, 3 days, we've cracked this private key for Gmail. Well, Google has a bunch of keys, and they change theirs every couple of weeks. They have a really strong private key regimen. But, you know, for your average website, the key is on there for 1 or 2 years or 3 years. And if you could crack it in as quick as 3 days, so you definitely need to make sure your SSL keys are 2048-bit. 1024 is just not strong enough anymore. But that's like almost crazy reasonable. I mean, like crazy possible that it only cost $1 million to crack this key.
Well, that's
in
300
days.
Moore's Law, right? I mean, the computing power. Well, Moore's Law originally applied. First of all, it's not a law; it's an observation. Second of all, it originally applied to the amount of transistors on a chip, but that also correlates to computing power. So when you have this computing power, and it correlates, really what it correlates to is our current way of building algorithms to use that computing power. So we have these algorithms that work on these particular types of computers, and the x86 structure is still the one that really has the most penetration, and figuring out how to use that to the best to basically... It's not quite brute force, because they do use some more sophisticated algorithms, but it's kind of like, I don't know how much you know about searching methods, but it's more like a merge sort type thing, where you start from a whole bunch of data, and you kind of slowly dribble your way down through it.
I'm not sure if come back up. So, like, password cracking, you can use those kinds of statistical breakdown things.
Yeah.
I don't think keys can be broken that way. I think they're pretty much still brute force.
Like, it may be the case.
Because I also saw a thing about, you know, how people crack passwords and how they throw them into the statistical analysis stuff. And it's pretty crazy. It's really crazy how they are able to find, you know, statistical patterns and stuff in passwords. And how certain sites... certain passwords gravitate towards certain sites.
Right.
And you think, okay, yeah, the user base are all going to be like Star Trek Spock, you know, like, or something like that. But it's not even that. But for some reason, certain sites breed certain kinds of passwords.
It's funny. I mean, what's interesting is also the prospects of using quantum computing in this way. And really, no one has developed a good algorithm for a quantum computer to do this sort of thing. But in theory, you could do it pretty easily if you could make a reasonable algorithm and you could structure your quantum system in that way. And the way the quantum system works, it's hard to describe really, but the idea is that quantum systems have to, they can be in superpositions and then they have to collapse into discrete states. They collapse into the state that is the lowest energy state, most likely, unless there are other things going on. But essentially you build up your system so it's in a superposition of possible states, and then when you analyze it, it should collapse into the states that work best. And that's the basic idea behind quantum computing.
I heard a weird thing about quantum networking, you know, like network links between quantum computing and using quantum there. You can't have a quantum internet, because if you use quantum type encryption to send it to the endpoint, if I want to send something to you and there's a router in the middle, it can't pass it.
Right.
So you can only have a quantum hub, you know, so you, everyone has to be on the same broadcast domain. So like,
right. As soon as it's,
yeah.
You break the quantum encryption as soon as you've actually observed it in some way.
You almost wonder if you could do something like Tor. Like, so I'm going to make a quantum packet to you, but I'm going to encapsulate it in a quantum packet to the router next to you, and put that in a packet quantum router next to that one, right? So, like, I put in a whole bunch of shells, right? It hits the first router, takes it out of the first shell, pass on the second router, takes it out of the next shell, pass on the next router, takes it out of the next shell. Then you get the one that's, you know, the inside. That's how Tor works, right? That's how Tor does its encryption.
I suppose... I'm trying to wonder if that's possible. And the reason why hubs would work is because you could is because of what is conventionally known as quantum teleportation, the idea that you can essentially put something along and have it be sort of mirrored to doing a certain type of process so that the same quantum state is then mirrored again and stretched along. As long as you don't disturb that system, it won't go quantum. But as soon as you start interpreting that system, you then destroy the quantum state.
Yeah, I don't expect to understand quantum networking very much, but just it's an interesting point that it can't be routed, right? You can't use it on a large, multifaceted network, you know?
I don't know if you can do it like a Tor thing, because as soon as you interact with the whole... Because you can't really encapsulate it in that sense, at least not that I understand it in a way you can do that. You can send pieces that maybe... What you can do is maybe send pieces that tell it where to go, open up that flow, and then send something across that flow.
Oh, kind of like a pre-director.
Right.
Yeah. Maybe. Maybe you should patent that. Maybe you just had a breakthrough.
Maybe.
You don't actually have the chops to do it. You just have to have the idea, right, to patent things. So.
You have to be... In order to patent something, you have to have a pre... robust idea and have to be just having this is a good idea is not good.
I'm sure it's easy to slip things to the patent office.
But then you have a whole fight on your hands.
Well, you just give it up to
do you want to be a patent troll?
Well, give it up to the public domain after you patent it.
Then you're a hero.
Exactly.
I guess that's one way to think of it, but I don't want to be a patent troll.
Well, that has to do with sex toys.
I can't think of any way to make sex toys better that hasn't already been.
Well, that's what someone said, and then they invented the fleshlight.
Well, yeah, the fleshlight is essentially a small version of a real doll. So I don't think there's anything significantly new about it.
Yes, but there's always something better.
Just the vagina part.
Put it in a Pringles can so no one knows that you're a perv. You got a list. I got nothing, so...
Yeah, we were talking before about how stuffy it is right now. We had this... It's been 90 for the past couple of days. It will be for the next couple of days. There's this big high-pressure zone basically right above us.
The humidity this afternoon was... insane.
Yeah.
I mean, I was outside for less than 5 minutes and my shirt was already wet. You know, I was sweating so much. It's like unreal. I've never been in such a humid, hot environment.
And what you get with that is you get bad air quality because the air just sort of sticks around. And so you start to see, I mean, it's really hazy as I was coming up. I noticed, I mean, you know, usually I'd put in my sunglasses. There's no need for that. It was so hazy. It was just, it's just gross, and I can't wait for it to be over. This is why summer sucks. Do you watch Drunk History?
No.
You should.
It's
very funny.
What is it? Online show?
It was online for a while. They had a couple, did a bunch of online stuff. They're still online. You go to YouTube or Funny or Die and see them. And then they picked it up by Comedy Central.
Oh, wait. It sounds vaguely familiar. I might have seen one on YouTube or something.
It's where, you know, they get somebody to be really drunk and describe something in history, and then they have, you know, actors talk out the... Or not talk out, but, you know, they... It's the voice of the person who's drunk, but then the actors are saying...
Kind of pantomiming it, like...
Kind of, yeah.
Out.
Okay. Yeah. And it's cool. Very funny. Because, it's very funny. This is our last show for at least 2 weeks.
Yep, you're on vacation, then I'm on vacation.
Yeah.
I've been listening to some How Did This Get Made.
Uh-huh.
And, like, once I started... Like, I listened to them early on, but it was just them in a room and stuff. The live shows are so good.
The live shows are really good. When they get to play off an audience, they really...
The live shows are so good. The Birdemic one was amazing. Uh-huh. They had Weird Al on. I mean, it was so good. And then I just listened to... Oh, the Howard the Duck one was
fantastic. They just did one on
Sharknado. They just put out
Sharknado, but they did a live one before that with Demolition Man. And Demolition Man, which is great too.
I gotta check that one. I have that one ready to play. It's just I'm like, oh, this podcast gets so good when it's in front of an audience.
Yeah, I mean, especially Jason Mantzoukas, he really knows how to play to an audience. Yeah. He's really good at that. But yeah, that show particularly plays well, and I think it's just because part of it is that the audience is reacting with the people when they bring up these ridiculous things in the movie, and everyone's sort of like, yeah, you know that part. And but you have these three very funny people plus an extra one to to bring about, and if you listen to the whole thing, you get sort of the weird character that Jeanne Raphael plays, which is sort of like she's semi-aware of things, and so sometimes she's completely unaware of things, but sometimes she'll catch things that nobody else caught, the Howard the Duck flying thing.
Yeah. They had to go find it. He really is trying to fly. I haven't seen Howard the Duck in forever. I saw it when I was a kid. So, like, it was almost like when Paul Scheer was talking about it, like his parents wouldn't let him watch it. You know, it was like really relating to that part of it, you know. But somehow I got my parents let me watch it. They probably regretted it when the naked duck boobs in the tub was getting on. That whole section trying to explain why ducks have boobs was so good.
So, yeah.
So, did you watch Sharknado?
I did not see Sharknado.
No, I haven't either. It sounds pretty horribly awesome.
It sounds like kind of a Birdemic type thing, right? But more self-aware?
Slightly. I mean, I don't think it seemed completely intentional. But, I mean, if you're a writer and if English is your first language, then it's going to come off more self-aware than Birdemic.
Yeah.
You know, that was a big part of it. I'm going to have to... It airs tomorrow, I think. I'm going to have to check it out. And just for a little bit. Hopefully I don't get hooked for the whole thing. But I just want to see sharks falling out of the sky and landing on people and swallowing them whole and, you know, and whatnot. So.
Yeah. The Sharknado is an interesting artifact of human civilization that will be... I mean, Al Gore never predicted this.
No. They're working on Sharknado 2, the resharkening.
I know. It's God, I don't even know what to think about that. Part of it is like, okay. I don't know. I wanted to discuss because when we heard the Trayvon Martin verdict, like when we were doing the show last week, and I was like, there may be riots. There were really no riots. And I'm glad to hear that. The only reason I thought there would be riots was because
he was black?
Because the media sort of played this up so much that it whips people into a frenzy. And, you know, and so it wasn't that he was black. It was that this has become such a touchstone for...
When did the Rodney King's riots...
That was
when he...
That was...
How long after the event? Was that at the end of the trial? Or I can't remember when the riots were for Rodney King. If it was when he was arrested, or
I think maybe when he was arrested. I think
the video got out. Something
yeah. That was almost 20 years ago now.
Right. Yeah. No, I was just curious. Like, when in the timeline, you know, what did the riots happen? Like, was it when the police were, you know, some of them were acquitted, I think, right, or something?
Maybe that was what was going on. The police acquitted of it. I don't remember, but. This is part of the reason why they
made 20 years ago. Bobbitt.
Oh,
it was 20 years ago, like last week.
Wow. Another sensational story.
Yep.
But yeah, the whole thing with Trayvon Martin is that, you know, with the Rodney King, it was really, it was the state. It was state actors causing this problem. And with this, it's more, it wasn't exactly state actor. It was state. The state made a law that allowed this guy to get away with doing what he did. And it's like he did everything by the law protected him from basically killing somebody. And what can you say except for change the law, but not, but there's no, it's not real reason to get angry at the person except for just the assumption that having laws around like that allow people to make, mm-hmm. which is that I'm allowed to kill people in these certain circumstances when you shouldn't, I think you shouldn't think that way. I mean, if you're going to have to shoot somebody, you can probably shoot them in the leg.
Not be that
big of a problem. I don't know.
You know, I wasn't listening to testimony, but, you know, there was some degree of a physical altercation, right?
Yes.
And when the adrenaline's pumping like that, you're not thinking, hey, I can shoot this guy and get away with it.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's not the thought that went through his head, you know, so...
It's not... The rational thought is not, oh, I can... There are stand-your-ground laws that means I can shoot this guy and get away with it. However, if you have been... If you know about stand-your-ground laws, you're allowed to carry a gun around with you, all these other things, then you don't have to make the rational decision because it's already in your mind that these sort of things are allowed. So, you know, your rational decision-making comes later. We already know that. But mm-hmm. it's built on your experiences and your knowledge of a situation. So the fact that he was basically allowed to run around with a loaded gun and do neighborhood watch, and the fact that he knew about stand your ground laws and all this other stuff contributed to his mind making the decision at the time that this was a situation where he was probably not in. It was probably not a situation where he was going to die.
What if a guy had a gun, right? I'm not trying to defend George Zimmerman. Just trying to talk out the situation. You know,
I'm just thinking the situation was he thought he was in some sort of danger of being hurt, and he thought that a reason or because of the culture that surrounded him, he thought a reasonable situation, a reasonable response is shoot the guy in the chest to, I could get hurt here.
Wasn't he on the ground, the guy on top of him? You really can't shoot him anywhere else. I mean, if that's the case, right? But
you pull your gun out, you can shoot him in other areas.
If he's like straddling you on top of you, like, beating, you know, bashing your head against the ground or whatnot. If that was the case, you can't shoot him in the leg. You might shoot yourself. You can't. It's either chest or head.
They right? shot him in the heart. Didn't shoot him in like a stomach or in.
Again, if you're in distress, you're not going to make that kind of distinction.
I don't know. I just think that there that it's a cultural thing that we have to work on. Both.
I sound like I'm defending the guy. He was a dumb shit for putting himself in the whole situation.
Right.
You know, he shouldn't have been there. He should have, you know. I'm just saying, take a different guy who's being attacked. Say he's a guy that's getting mugged, and then the same altercation happens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the situation I'm defending, right? How you choose where to shoot the guy,
right?
That's all I'm defending is that situation.
Not being a gun guy, I really don't know totally how to respond to that, and I can't give the best way to respond to that. It just seems like. Yeah, Zimmerman put himself in a situation that allowed him to be able to kill this guy, and that it would have been better had he just simply not put himself in that sort of situation. That would have been better for everybody. But here we are.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go drink some beers.
On that note...